Okay. Well, the Anarchist FAQ website, that's the Anarchist Frequently Asked Questions website, is reflective of broad anarchist opinion. And it lists Max Stirner, Pierre Joseph Proudhon, Michael Bakunin, and Peter Kropotkin as the major anarchist theorists. And so what did they stand for, and what impact do their ideas have on the anarchist movement today? Let's start with Max Stirner, famous for his 1844 book, The Ego and His Own. Now, according to the Anarchist FAQ, Stirner's ideas remain a cornerstone of anarchism. In the words of the Anarchist FAQ again, Stirner argued for, quote, an extreme form of individualism, which placed the individual above all else. Stirner believed that the concept of workers' solidarity was, quote, quite incomprehensible. Indeed, for Stirner, there was no social morality other than the demands of the individual ego. I would argue there is nothing at all in any sense left-wing or progressive about such an approach. Stirner was a reactionary, self-centered individualist. Stirner was not in any meaningful sense anti-capitalist either. He supported a market economy and rejected political or social revolution or so-called ego rebellion. And reflecting his reactionary outlook, Stirner didn't involve himself at all in the 1848 revolution that swept across Germany. Though on the basis of his extreme individualism, Stirner was anti-authority, anti-hierarchy, and anti-state. Now, to be fair, there are some anarchists, for example, Lucien van der Walt and Michael Smith in their book Black Flame, who reject the view that figures like Stirner, or Proudhon for that matter, are part of the anarchist tradition. They argue that individualist anarchists and lifestyle anarchists are not genuinely anarchists, and that only class struggle anarchism is truly anarchism. Now, if that was true, it would be a step forward and bring anarchism much closer to Marxism. But as van der Walt and Smith themselves concede, their standpoint is very much a minority view amongst anarchists. They acknowledge that Stirner and other reactionary individualists like Nietzsche have had a significant impact on the anarchist movement. And this is very apparent, you know, from any examination of the Anarchist FAQ, which repeatedly quotes Stirner favourably and is obsessed with the need for, quote, individual sovereignty. It emphasises the individual much more than it emphasises working class collective struggle. The Anarchist FAQ, for example, states, quote, anarchists recognise that individuals are the basic units of society, and that only individuals have interests and feelings. It proclaims the need for individuals to free themselves. This is a total negation of a class analysis of society. Individuals simply cannot free themselves from capitalist rule. Freedom can only be attained from collective working class struggle that overthrows the rule of the capitalist class. And it is palpably not the case that only individuals have interests. The working class has its own collective interests to improve its living standards and to free itself from capitalist rule. But to free itself as a class, a collective body, not as discrete individuals. The Anarchist FAQ also argues, quote, for anarchists, the idea that individuals should sacrifice themselves for the group or greater good is nonsensical. But in any mass struggle, that is precisely what the exploited and the oppressed have done time and time again. You just look at, you know, the protests that are going on in Myanmar over the last year or so. Some brave souls put themselves in the front line knowing that they could well be shot and that. They do that for a broader cause, not for their own individual ego fulfillment. Similarly, in virtually every strike, individual workers make financial sacrifices to advance the interests of their social group, whether it's their immediate workplace or in the hope that if they have a victory, this can flow on and improve the living standards of the working class across the board. Similarly, we see it in the current health crisis, that healthcare workers risk their lives time and time again to look after sick people. They do that as a part of a social responsibility, which reflects the fact that human beings are social animals, not just individual egoists. Now, this strong emphasis on individualism is not just some foible of the anarchist FAQ. Bakunin was strongly influenced by Stirner, and Proudhon saw freedom very much in individual terms, not in terms of working class collective struggle. Similarly, Emma Goldman, in many ways the preeminent anarchist of the 20th century, insisted, quote, that for anarchists, the center of gravity in society is the individual, and that, quote, the essential principle of anarchy is individual autonomy. And as Van der Waal and Schmidt note, even many anarchists who would like to distance themselves from individual anarchists or the extreme type of individualism put forward by Stirner and do accept the need for some sort of organisation, they do so hesitantly and are for some sort of loose organisation. And this reflects a very common idea amongst anarchists that it is somehow authoritarian for an organisation to have, you know, clearly defined political viewpoints and that, and organises and coheres around itself on a clear political program. The ongoing influence of individualism amongst anarchists is also reflect the fact that in many anarcho-syndicalists and anarcho-communists who see themselves as class struggle anarchists, but still, on the other hand, refuse to totally disavow and cut themselves off from individual anarchists and lifestyle anarchism, and by default go along with a lot of their swampy individualist ideas, in particular around identity politics, the dominant form of individual, liberal identity politics today. You know, individual, puts individual core at the centre of their worldview. But moving on from Stirner to Proudhon. Now, Pierre-Joseph Proudhon was famous for his phrase, property is theft, and he's widely recognised in anarchist circles as the founder of anarchism. As the anarchist FAQ puts it, quote, it would be no exaggeration to state that Proudhon's work defined the fundamental nature of anarchism. Both Bakunin and Kropotkin admired Proudhon. Bakunin stated that his own ideas were simply Proudhon's ideas, widely developed and pushed to their final consequences. And there's no doubting that Proudhon was one of the most influential radical figures in France in the 1840s and 1850s. It was reflected in the fact that he was elected to Parliament, first in a by-election, then with an increased majority at the May 1849 general election. And the Proudhonist current was the major radical current in France for a couple of decades, and it played a substantial, if often negative, role in the 1871 Paris Commune. Proudhon, though, promoted a litany of reactionary ideas that today anarchists would be embarrassed by and would want to disavow. I've not time to go through a full charge sheet, but here is some sort of representative sample. Proudhon was hostile to strikes and at times called for them to be suppressed by the authorities. In his election campaign, he called on workers to, quote, offer their employers the hand of friendship. He opposed voting rights for workers, declaring universal suffrage is the counter-revolution. He was anti-Semitic and supported the right of the slave-owning states of the U.S. South to secede at the time of the U.S. Civil War. He idealized the nuclear family as the fundamental unit of society. And for that reason, he opposed divorce and sexual freedom, especially for women. He was an extreme sexist, notoriously declaring, quote, a woman knows enough if she knows enough to mend our shirts and cook us a steak. And when it came to political strategy, Proudhon was a reformist, making it clear in a letter to Karl Marx that he opposed violent revolution. Yet despite all this, Proudhon has been upheld by anarchists as a champion of human freedom as opposed to the supposedly authoritarian Marx. And Proudhon's reactionary ideas have been brushed aside or covered up by numerous anarchist writers. There are, as I said, a few honourable exceptions, like van der Walten Smith, but they are in a very much a minority, with book after book by anarchists championing Proudhon. All this reflects the fact that many of Proudhon's core ideas remain central to anarchism today. Proudhon's central idea was hostility to all forms of authority as an infringement on individual freedom, which, like Stirner, he championed. Proudhon saw authority, whether it be God or above all the state, as a fundamental problem in society. He viewed the state as opposed to the natural order of things. Human freedom would be automatic if the state simply disappeared. And Proudhon's classless opposition to authority led him to impose even taxation on the rich as oppressive. Similarly, he opposed the nationalisation of the banks and so on. And following this anti-statist abstract nonsense, Proudhon opposed all state welfare measures, including old age pensions. Proudhon's second core principle was opposition to all forms of centralism, which he saw as authoritarian. He was for a completely decentralized society, which he believed was somehow progressive. Because of this fetish for decentralization, as I said, he supported the right of the slave states of the South to break away. The epitome of a totally classless worldview. Thirdly, as his alternative ideal world, Proudhon argued that small producers and workers switch out their own companies to compete with capitalist-owned companies, compete on the market. And they would supposedly then run the capitalists out of business. At the centre point of this fantasy was the so-called People's Bank, which would provide cheap credit to the small producer-owned companies. And now this schema was called mutualism, and which argued that it could succeed simply by ignoring the state. Definitely there should be no recourse to violence by the oppressed. The worker-owned companies would be federated together by mutual agreement. The state would become redundant. The market, however, would continue. And for Proudhon, he saw individuals competing on the market as important to ensure that they worked hard. Now, this has to be said, is a pretty standard market-based petty bourgeois utopia, reflecting the social class from which Proudhon came. Proudhon had owned a printing business that went broke, and this libertarian saw the paper he edited as very much his own property, subject to his dictatorial control. Proudhon declared that under his schema, retail trade should be left to the small shopkeeper. Indeed, he championed the supposed right to own a small business. Similarly, peasants should have their own land and compete on the market, etc. According to Proudhon, it was only large-scale industry, which he viewed unfavourably, that should be run as worker-owned companies. But he opposed workers seizing capitalist properties. Unsurprisingly, this whole mutualist schema collapsed in the heap in the face of the test of practice, reflecting his own naivety and contradicting his own anti-state principles. Proudhon called on the government to set up the People's Bank. When, unsurprisingly, the capitalist government of the day refused to do so, then Proudhon set up a People's Bank on the basis of individual subscriptions. In turn, it quickly collapsed. Though it should be noted that this supposed libertarian placed himself solely in charge of the bank, the dictator of the bank. The whole project, of course, is another fantasy. As though the capitalist class and the state was ever going to allow themselves to be peacefully forced out of existence by competition from worker-owned enterprises. If they had become any sort of threat, the capitalists would have used their police and army to crush them. The final core element of Proudhon's approach was hostility to political organisation and political parties, and to politics in a more general sense. a form of anti-politics. For Proudhon, the masses should not look to political solutions to their problems. They should instead rely on their economic strength. In the 1848 revolution, no revolutionary working class party existed to cohere the ranks of the rebellious workers of Paris and attempt to take the initiative in the struggle. Proudhon's influential anti-party current opposed workers attempting to challenge the state, let alone taking power into their own hands. The result was a terrible defeat for workers and horrific repression. Later anarchists like Kropotkin and Bakunin ditched some of the more outlandish features of Proudhon's ideas. I don't know of any anarchists today, for example, who oppose divorce or taxes on the rich, or champion a people's bank as the solution to society's problems. Nonetheless, as the anarchist FAQ acknowledged, Proudhon's core principles still profoundly influence anarchism. Bakunin and various other anarchists saw themselves as revolutionaries and rejected Proudhon's reformist approach that capitalism could be gradually abolished or fade away in the face of competition from producer-owned enterprises. But Proudhon's reformist orientation is embodied in the approach of lifestyle and individualist anarchists. And they form, I think, quite clearly the overwhelming majority of anarchists today. Lifestyle anarchists believe that living an alternative lifestyle in communes, squats or wherever, by eating ethically, dumpster diving, running soup kitchens and so on, that they can escape from the state and or make it irrelevant and thus lay the basis for freedom. Just like Proudhon, they don't see the collective mass struggle of the working class as the key to liberating humanity. But it's not just lifestyle anarchists who don't recognise that it is only the working class and the collective power of the working class that can overthrow capitalism and establish a society of human freedom. Various anarchists who see themselves as revolutionaries, as anarcho-syndicalists or anarcho-communists, look to other social classes or other social layers other than the working class to eliminate society. Bakunin, for example, looked to the peasants, criminal elements, and students as well as workers. The Narodniks in Russia saw the workers as being irrelevant and looked to the peasantry as the revolutionary force. And down to this very day, anarchists and very large number of them looked to an idealised Nasna Makhno's reactionary peasant army in Russia as the force that could have established an anarchist society. And even some of the most left-wing anarchists, like van der Waal and Schmidt, view the peasants as a revolutionary class and champion Makhno, evidence of the fact that they don't have a thoroughgoing class analysis of society. The continued influence of Proudhon's petty bourgeois utopian ways is also reflected in anarchist circles in their opposition to centralised working class power and their support instead for decentralised small-scale local communities or collectives linked together in some sort of loose federation. In Proudhon's case, support for decentralisation reflected the hostility of peasants, shopkeepers and other small employers to the growth of big business on a large scale, you know, industry employing masses of workers. But I think we have to be very clear that there's nothing at all progressive about decentralisation. It was precisely the bringing of workers together in large numbers in cities and large workplaces that laid the basis for working class power and for democratic control over society. Workers, for example, and we see it very much till today, in large workplaces, whether it be supermarkets or hospitals and so on, have much more potential power than workers, the tiny number of people that work in your local GP clinic or corner store. And it's not simply lifestyle anarchists who want to live in a hippie commune or wherever that oppose centralisation. The anarchist FAQ is stridently for decentralisation. However, centralisation is inherently more democratic than localised decision-making. You can't discipline your trade union leaders and hold them accountable simply by passing motions at the local level. There needs to be a centralised challenge to them. Moreover, centralised decision-making is vital for working-class people to resolve the key challenges facing them, whether it's over their living standards, over climate change, the COVID crisis, the refugee question, or imperialist war. You can't, you know, stop a war between between China and the US by decentralization and that. You can only stop it at a mass centralized level. Furthermore, the capitalist class and its state is centrally organized. If it is to be defeated, it needs to be confronted by centralized working class power, not by local federated groups. The continuing influence of Proudhon's ideas, even amongst those anarchists who claim to be class struggle anarchists, is most pronounced around the question of the state. Like Proudhon, their theoretical starting point is hostility to all forms of authority and hierarchy. This leads anarchists to oppose the working class imposing its rule on society via a worker state, even the most democratic, the most extreme democratic one imaginable. Even the most democratic worker state, as far as anarchists are concerned, is reactionary as the capitalist state. And so this is extreme abstract anti-statism, leads to equate a worker state, society ruled by workers, and a society ruled by capitalists. And this means in a revolutionary situation, when the working class is contending for power, fighting to impose its own rule on society, anarchists either end up being paralyzed and politically paralyzed and irrelevant to the struggle, or to the anarchists arguing directly against workers taking power into their own hands. But as Leon Trotsky famously put it, to renounce the conquest of power is voluntarily to leave the power with those who wield it, the exploiters. This is precisely what happened in the 1936 revolution in Spain, when the powerful anarcho-syndicalists of the CNT, the National Confederation of Labour, refused to take power, even when they were overwhelmingly the dominant force in Catalonia. The CNT leaders argued that taking power was corrupting and against their anti-authoritarian principles. All this did was strengthen the hand of the counter-revolution, strengthen the hand of the Stalinists and the reformists, who then went on to rebuild the bourgeois state and eventually crush the revolution. Even worse, the anarchist leaders, after refusing to support the establishment of worker state, then took positions as ministers in the bourgeois state, the central republican government. Their refusal to make a distinction between a worker state and a capitalist state ended up leading them to act as just another bunch of run-of-the-mill reformist politicians propping up the bourgeois order. But well short of revolutionary situation, the anarchist shibboleth of opposition to all authority and consequently seeing the state in all its forms as the main enemy undermines their ability to advance working class interests and leads them to strengthen the position of the reformists. It is absolutely ahistorical to suggest that at all times, in all places, it is the state that is the main enemy of human freedom. Socialists should be, for example, vigorously opposing privatization of state-run services that are vital for the needs of working-class people. In the COVID crisis, the left-wing demand is for better health services, for more money being spent on them, and so on. Proudhon's abstract anti-statism has had a long-lasting influence on the approach of anarchists who often oppose reforms for workers which were handed down from above by the state, whether it be the legislation for the 8-hour working day, welfare state measures, a state-run central health service, the nationalisation of core public services. So, for example, in the course of the 1871 Paris Commune and subsequently in the 1936 Spanish Revolution, anarchists opposed nationalising the banks. Similarly, for long decades after Proudhon's death, considerable section of anarchists and anarcho-syndicalists opposed campaigns for the right to vote. So, for example, prominent US IWW, that's Industrial Workers of the World leader, Elizabeth Gurley Flint, argued the campaigning for the right to vote for women was irrelevant to working class women. This approach simply abandoned the leadership of the women's suffrage movement to bourgeois and middle-class forces who were not interested in the rights of the working-class women and who sought to limit the demands of the campaign to a quite restricted franchise. Similarly, anarchist opposition to state welfare measures only served to isolate themselves from workers who were vitally dependent on things like age pensions. It simply pushed the workers back into the arms of the reformists. The anarchists then had no strategy for undermining the whole of political reformism. They tended to just denounce the reformist leaders from the sidelines, rather than placing demands on the reformists when they were in government to deliver more for workers. This is one of the key tactical approaches socialists use to put the reformists to the test and expose their shortcomings when they fail to deliver for workers. The anarchist abstract shibboleth about opposition to all authority, hierarchy in all states ties into a broader anti-politicism and anarchism, which takes a variety of forms. Most, though not all anarchists, are hostile to political parties. Bakunin did, of course, form his own secret political party, and not a very democratic one at that, but this is basically denied by most anarchists. Secondly, most anarchists oppose engaging in parliamentary elections. Thirdly, there is a hostility amongst anarchists to a united front approach to political reformism, i.e., an approach where it sees revolutionaries calling on the reformists to engage in joint struggles around defence of basic working class rights and living standards. In the course of these struggles, revolutionaries attempt to demonstrate the superiority of their approach to winning these demands to that of the reformists. The anarchist abstract opposition to the state and to politics means that they abstain from these areas of political struggle, which simply plays into the hands of the reformists. Okay, to wind up, what then is the Marxist alternative? The starting point for Marxists in determining our political strategy is a concrete class analysis of society. Marxists understand that the only force that can have has the power to overthrow capitalist rule and establish a genuinely democratic collective society is the working class. Marxists, unlike anarchists, do not start from some abstract principle of individual autonomy. Human beings are not discrete, isolated individuals. They are social individuals that engage in collective labour and collective struggle. Consequently, as Marx put it in his great work, Capital, freedom can consist only in this, that socialised human beings, the associated producers, govern the human metabolism with nature in a rational way, bring in under their common control instead of being dominated by it as a blind power. To move down that road, the working class must utilise its organised collective power to establish its own rule. There's no reformist road to human liberation. A working class revolution is necessary to break the power of the capitalist class and its state, but also because it is in the course of collective revolutionary struggle that mass consciousness is fundamentally transformed and workers make themselves fit to rule a new society and establish a social society. Workers need to smash the existing state apparatus and establish their own state power based on their own democratic organs of power, workers' councils. To lead that struggle and to have any hope of victory, the most politically advanced workers need to be organised in a disciplined, democratic, revolutionary socialist party that argues for a political direction, for specific tactics and strategy to take the revolution forward to victory. A party that offers a fighting alternative to the reformist forces that would always attempt to derail any mass revolt. And I'll leave it there.